Throughout human history, people have always taken psychoactive drugs, substances that change our mental functioning. We take them to improve our mood or to escape our emotional pain. Many times we take them because we used them one time too many in the past and got addicted. In any society, some psychoactive drugs are sanctioned and some are not. And a whole bunch of consequences flow from which side of the legal divide your drug of choice falls on. Many public health officials argue that we need to re-examine how we manage psychoactive drugs in our society, especially those that we've made illegal. The Health Officers Council is an organization representing medical health officers in BC. This month, they produced a discussion paper on drug control in Canada. Dr. Richard Mathias is a professor in the Department of Healthcare and Epidemiology at UBC and a member of the Health Officers Council, and he joins me by phone this morning. Hello, Richard.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, what are some of the harms that are caused when a drug is illegal? I'm not asking here about the physical effects on the person who takes the drugs, but the broader harms that result in certain drugs being prohibited.
Well, first of all, it makes somebody a criminal, and therefore puts them at risk of the law, of having criminal charges brought, of then having their futures change dramatically because of those. For example, travel to other countries, getting jobs, those kinds of things. Secondly, because these drugs are associated with criminality, there's no sort of legal supply, or so that the individual then needs to buy from somebody in the black market, where the prices are not controlled, the purity of the drugs are not controlled, and often in order to be able to afford this habit, they then may find themselves rejected by society and having to resort to criminal activity in order to pay for their habit.
Now, you quote data in the discussion papers that says that the greatest harm to the user from illegal drugs comes from the enforcement of criminal sanctions, which in a way it seems counterintuitive when you think of the health effects of a drug like crack or heroin. But you say it's the greatest harm.
Oh, unquestionably. I mean, most people don't realize that drugs, many of them that we take over the counter, have side effects. And some of them, actually, if you take them for too long or in too high a dose, have toxic or poisonous effects. Both tobacco and alcohol, if you take them at a sufficient dose for long enough, are poisonous. And that's why we have lung cancer, for example, with tobacco, and liver cirrhosis or and liver failure and death from alcohol. Those are dose-related things. Heroin, on the other hand, is very safe. It really is not a toxic drug at all. And its unfortunate side effect is addiction, but it's not inherently poisonous as some of the legal drugs are. So that often what happens is not due to the effects of the drug itself, it's due to the way people have to take it because it's illegal and because they're buying it from the black market.
You say that paradoxically, in a way, the harms to drug users are highest with either unfettered legalization or with full prohibition. So there's two ends of the spectrum. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. We have tried to avoid the use of the term legalization here because many of your listeners will immediately perceive legalization equals free market. And having a free market in drugs, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, or any of the currently illegal drugs, is not the aim of Health Officers Council. What we're looking for is a regulated market where the harms that a drug can do and the benefits that it has for the users can be balanced, and where the responses to those benefits and risks can be tailored to the specific drug, and they're not just a broad brush that washes over a huge range of things, but rather where we can look very specifically at individual drugs and use a public health approach rather than that broad and rather indefinite approach of prohibition.
What's stopping us from moving towards that middle ground, but both on the one hand of when you think about tobacco and alcohol, and then the other hand when you think about drugs that we think about now as street drugs?
Sure. Well, we know. I mean, when I was a youth, probably 60 to 75% of my cohort smoked. And we know that using a public health approach, we can drop that way down. In fact, if we had a really true public health approach, we could probably get it lower than the current statistics in BC, which are really very good in terms of the numbers of people who are using alcohol. Well, I don't know, you know, as a youth, having people driving while drunk was not an uncommon thing at all. Now it's becoming perhaps too common, but very much less. So the public health approach works. We've seen that. We're not allowed to take that approach with illegal drugs. We can't work to reduce the harms of the drugs and to make them safe, as safe as possible, particularly in two contexts. One, so that the people who are using it know what the adverse effects are, so that the people who are using a drug are basically doing so with informed consent. And that's really a very key part of our paper, is that people need good, reliable information so they can make their own decisions, because most people will make good decisions if they have the right information. And the second thing is that I don't want young people going to a black market to buy their drugs. I think that they should have some confidence that the drugs they're buying are what they think they are and haven't been adulterated. So those are a couple of the points that we're trying to make in terms of how to deal with this. Why hasn't it been done? That's a very good question. Since the Ledain Commission back in the 60s, every commission has consistently been saying this, that prohibition doesn't work. And I don't think anybody who looks at the drug situation thinks that prohibition is currently working to the goal of having the minimum amount of harm. So if something isn't working, you have sort of two options. You can do more, or you can change the paradigm. And what we're saying is it's time to change the paradigm.
So what kind of a model do you want people to be thinking of if they imagine what it would be like to remove the prohibition from a drug like, for example, cocaine?
Okay. What we are basically looking at is first of all, for cocaine, much of its harms are in the methods, in the purity and the strength of the drug, so that in order to smuggle it, literally, you have to have the volume as small as possible to make it easier to smuggle it. We would, first of all, much rather make coca leaves, which have been used for millennia in the Andes, as a tea, perhaps the preferred choice of people who want a stimulant, because that's basically what cocaine is. If people want something that's been manufactured, such as cocaine, then we want to make sure that they can take it in the safest route possible, which generally means not injecting, because injecting tends to be a very unsafe way of taking a drug. So the public health approach is to make sure that the drug used is safe, that the people know why they're taking it, and that they know what they're getting. So fundamentally, that's what we would do. We would very much discourage crack cocaine. We would very much discourage injectable cocaine. And the use would then become much safer for the individual and for the people around them.
And where would they get that drug? Are we looking at a kind of a doctor's office kind of situation, or a liquor control board kind of a model? Or
well, we've talked about several models. For example, if we were for coca leaves and actually for marijuana as well, it's basically a natural product. If it hasn't been adulterated or manufactured or made more concentrated, then perhaps it would be worthwhile thinking of either of those as natural products and put them under natural products regulation in terms of where they're sold. We might very well put restrictions on them in terms of where they're used and at what age individuals can obtain these products. for drugs that are more concentrated, then what we really want to make sure is that before somebody accesses such a drug, that they know pretty much what the harms are, and so that they can take the drug as safely as possible. For a drug which is injectable, for example, our visualization is that would need to come from somebody who's very well trained in these things, such as a pharmacist, so that it could be single dose, known purity, have a needle and syringe that cannot be reused, because sharing is one of the big issues, but also available enough that people can actually get the drug when they need it in the quantity that suits their life, that supports their ability to go and work and to become a member of society.
One of the arguments that I'm sure you've heard 100 times yourself is that when we talk about removing the prohibition, and people, as you say, it's known as legalization, though you rightly commented on the problem with that, is that people look at the drugs that we have that are currently legal, like tobacco and like alcohol, and they say, well, we've done such a very bad job of that. What's your response to that argument?
Well, first of all, the free market approach to tobacco and alcohol is terrible. It in many ways maximizes the benefits for the manufacturer and distributors without any consideration of the harms that it may be doing to the people who are using it. And that's why we tried prohibition in this country in the early 1900s for a few years, and why the U.S. tried it a few years later. What we've done, though, is that Canada quickly realized that prohibition wasn't the way to go, and that what we needed to have is regulation. We needed to have restrictions on use. We needed to make it very clear to people that if they used this drug, alcohol, in such a way that it harmed others, they were going to put themselves at major risk, and that there were going to be major legal liabilities at putting other people to risk. That is drinking and driving, impaired driving. And so what we've done is we've reduced the harms from that. We don't think that we can reduce the harms to zero. Even as with alcohol and others, there are some people where the drugs are going to cause the individual harm. So that one of the things that we have very strongly in our proposal is rehabilitation. That is, trying to make sure that the person who is having difficulty with the drugs has support in order to use that drug as safely and as little, hopefully, as possible, and that treatment is available for that individual when they want it. And it needs to be available right away. So very much part of our model is safe use, no harm for others. That's not acceptable under any context. And rehabilitation and treatment when individuals need those activities.
Given the hullabaloo that developed in response to the opening of Vancouver's safe injection site, it seems like we're a long way away from being able to have a reasonable conversation about this kind of thing. Why is it such a hot button issue?
Well, I think there are probably three things. The first one is that there are people who truly think that the morality of the situation is that if there is a law, no matter how good or how bad, that people should just go ahead and obey it, and there shouldn't be any further discussion of it. We don't feel that way. We feel that bad laws should be changed to reflect something which helps the people to the maximum extent. So there's that moral group. Another group which sometimes feel threatened by this are people who perhaps who are in enforcement areas and in prisons and things, and who think that this will result in a threat to their jobs and livelihood. And again, you know, that's quite understandable, and I think we can discuss that, because I don't think that will happen at all. The third group is the tough one. The bud trade in BC is worth something over $4 billion, at least by some estimates. It's estimated to be the number one agricultural crop in British Columbia. And what that means is that there are a large number of people who are making a great deal of money from the illicit drug trade, and they do not want it changed. They will use whatever means within their power to prevent any change in the drug laws. Because this is an illegal activity, they can't come and say, we want prohibition to remain because I'm making money on it, and I have certain rights, and so it should stay the way that they can't do that. They did that with tobacco, by the way. And at least we knew that the people who were fighting the public health regulation of tobacco, we knew who they were. We're not going to know who they are with the illicit drugs, and they're going to come forward probably with the moral argument that this is the law, and the law should remain what it is, and people should obey it. And we don't care what harms come to them. We don't care that people are dying in the downtown east side because it's moral. And the fact that people die from it, well, we're not going to worry about the morality of that. It's this illicit money in very large quantities that is going to play a major role and unfortunately is a huge corrupting influence on politicians and others. I think less in Canada than in the U.S., where the drug trade is clearly very corrupting to police departments and others. I don't think we're at that stage here, which is why we have some hope that we can bring this forward in Canada. But the opposition is going to be very strong, and very strong and very hard to identify on what basis they're opposing a public health framework.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Richard. It's been really interesting.
Well, thanks, Jane, and thank you very much for bringing this forward, and we hope that your listeners will think about this and support the Health Officers Council in this fight.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Dr. Richard Mathias. He's a professor in the Department of Healthcare and Epidemiology at UBC and a member of the Health Officers Council. The discussion paper we've been talking about is available online at the website of the organization Keeping the Door Open, and you can find them at keepingthedooropen.com.